And my friend will come for us all.
Hey, Samantha, guess what?
What?
It's almost our 100th episode, and you know what that means.
Special episode time and also Bigfoot?
Yep, Bigfoot. That's right. If you are so inclined and you want to know more information about us, we are going to do a bonus Q&A episode for you. So be sure to write us in at ReaperGals@ReaperTales.com to submit your questions. You can also reach us, mostly Samantha, on our social media at
Reaper Tales Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
We will consider all and any questions as long as they're appropriate. We're not going to tell you our bra sizes. I'm sorry. Anyways, we look forward to our 100th episode, and we can't wait to hear from you.
Hello, I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
Kelsey almost got caught on the mic. And you're listening to
Reaper Tales.
And today, for Women's History Month, I am going to be talking about Bessie Coleman. But before we get started, Samantha, what are we drinking?
You are drinking, because it's still a bit early for me, the Queen Bee. And apparently there are two options here, and I will give you both. One is with whiskey and one is with gin. If I had to guess, I'm going to assume Montana did the one with gin.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the one that Montana decided to go with is going to be 2 ounces of gin, a half an ounce of honey syrup, a half an ounce of fresh lime juice, half an ounce of fresh lemon juice, 3/4 ounce Jack Rudy Classic tonic syrup. And didn't you have to do a substitution for that?
Yeah, I just used bitters that I had. It's supposed to be
4 to 5 ounces of club soda. Basically, that's to top it. So that's why it's variable. You're going to stir the first 4 ingredients together and pour into a glass with ice, and then top with the club soda, garnish with lime or lemon rind twist. And then the go ahead.
I will say that it says to stir the ingredients. I would suggest putting it in a shaker with ice, because I did the stir one and I just couldn't get the honey to mix as well. I think a shaker would do better.
Well, especially if it's cold. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The alternative with whiskey is going to be somewhat similar, but you're going to do 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 3/4 ounce dry sherry, 3/4 ounce honey syrup, 1/4 ounce of fresh lemon juice, so no lime in this one, and 2 sprigs of rosemary. And then this one actually says to shake the first 4 ingredients, so I don't know why you didn't shake the first one, but...
I don't know.
I think gin can get bruised sometimes when you shake it, I've heard. But I don't really drink gin, so I wouldn't know.
Well, you can do the first things and just not add, you can add the gin after, I guess.
That's true. There you go. We're figuring it out. But in this one, you're going to shake the first 4 ingredients and the sprig of rosemary together in a cocktail shaker with ice, strained into a glass filled with crushed ice, and then garnish with a remaining sprig of rosemary. I can't cheers you because I'm drinking water. But
oh, true. Well, cheers to myself.
Enjoy.
It is good. It's very good. But I'm a big gin person, so, you know, it is what it is. I didn't know gin could be bruised. Like, I've shaken gin drinks plenty of times, and it didn't seem to be hurt.
It's just a term I've heard before where somebody has said something about making a gin drink without bruising it.
Oh,
but
that's
again,
weird.
Like I said, I don't drink gin, so...
Yeah, what's Celtic got for us?
It says, when you agitate gin, say by shaking it for a martini, you're causing the top notes to dissipate. Those bits of pine and botanicals that you look forward to start breaking down and become dull. The end result, a cocktail that's nowhere near as crisp as it should be. This is what we call bruising.
Oh, well, there we go.
I didn't teach, but I brought up something new for Montana. So there's your thing that you learned today. You're welcome. Thanks, Kelsey, for looking
Thank
it
you.
Up.
Well, it's good. I mean, I love gin, and that is what I look forward to, is that like crisp, woodsy taste to it, piney taste.
I don't really like drinking a drink that tastes like one of those pine tree air fresheners, but that's just me.
I don't know. It just, it's refreshing. Like, I used to be like that. I was like, ew, gin and tonic is so gross. But I didn't realize, like, I was drinking, like, bottom shelf gin in those at the bar.
Yeah, that'll definitely make a difference.
So getting, like, a good gin makes all the difference. I mean, typically I'm like, eh, whatever, when it comes to things like vodka or you know, because it's so basic. But gin, you definitely want, like, a good gin. Anyways, this podcast is not a gin podcast. So fair. I'm gonna tell you about Bessie Coleman, who is quite a badass, right up there with Junko Taibe, which everybody loved that episode. Thank you. Great feedback on it.
It was a good episode.
It was. I liked her a lot. A lot of my information for the show came from National Geographic, Britannica articles, and Women's History articles. So you can look at that. There's also some weird links in the resources. If you go to it, there's one for chili. So we'll get to why that's there in a little bit. But yeah, if you are one of the people who ever goes in there and looks at the links, sometimes I put weird things in there that I've looked up in the process of researching that has, like, literally nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I used it as, like, a resource, so I have to put it in the show notes.
Bonus Easter eggs if anybody catches them.
Yes. Anyway, so Elizabeth Coleman was born on January 26, 1892, in Atlanta, Texas. Yeah, I didn't know there was an Atlanta in Texas. I was like, Georgia, and then, whoa, look, Texas got one too. Which, I mean, they're huge. They probably have everything.
A lot.
Yeah. She was the 10th of 13 children. And when I originally wrote this, I went back and looked at it last night, and I was like, that doesn't make sense, because I wrote it as she was the 10th of 9 children, which technically she is, because only 9 of the children survived childhood.
Oh, okay.
I was like, well, people are not going to understand that unless you, like, say this. So you need to say the original.
Like, oh, no. Montana's not mathing right again.
Well, considering my job is mostly math and programming, you would think I'd be better at it, but I'm not.
No, just because we do it for a living doesn't mean we're actually good at it.
Bingo. Her mother, Susan Coleman, was an African-American, and her father is believed to be of African-American and either Cherokee or Choctaw ancestry. I'm leaning more towards Choctaw simply because National Geographic stated Choctaw, and I find them to be more reputable than Wikipedia.
Maybe.
Just a smidge. Early life for Bessie wasn't easy. At 2, her family moved to, I'm not going to say this right, but if you live in Texas, don't come at me, Waxahachie, Texas, to become sharecroppers. I nailed it. Kelsey's looking it up.
Speaking of imposter syndrome.
it's really bad because, like, we didn't record for a couple of weeks. Did I say it right? Okay, I did. Look, hey, if you guys pronounce it a weird way, like Louisville.
Kelsey, write that one down. That's going to be, that'll be a clip.
Hey, I got it right.
Oh, my God.
I'm struggling because, like, we didn't record for 2 weeks, listeners, and I almost died last week. That sounds dramatic. I am dramatic. I had COVID, and, like, I've had COVID one other time, and that first time it was not bad, but this time, deathbed. I was already writing my own eulogy. It was over. I was done for.
I actually believe you 100% that you did. Yeah. I actually bet you had 2 versions, one that was supposed to be, like, super sad and one that was going to be funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to make you read both of them.
Oh, fun.
While you cry.
Get to practice my acting technique.
Oh, you love me so much. Anyway. Her life revolved around school, working the fields with her family, and church. So they moved to this new Waxahachie in Texas to become sharecroppers. Do you know what sharecropping is?
It's been a while, but yeah. I mean, but why don't we go ahead and explain it anyway, just in case?
I wasn't sure like what it was. So I just like kind of skimmed to see what it was. And it's basically like landowners would kind of like rent out their land to families, and those families would stay on the land and then they would grow crops to sell. And so the landowner would get like a percentage of what that the crops were sold for. It's
basically what it sounds like. They share the crops that they grew. Well, the profits, pretty much. Really.
Not only did she have to like work on this farm, and she went to school and church and had all these chores, she had to walk 4 miles to get to school every day.
And honestly, she probably was barefoot. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. And she went uphill both ways.
I believe
she
it.
She is like a determined person. So like 4 miles is nothing for her. She was an avid reader and an outstanding math student. In 1901, George Coleman moved to Oklahoma, which at the time the area was known as Indian Territory. He moved in order to find a better opportunities for himself, but he left behind his family and went on his own. So that left the family to take care of themselves. At the age of 12, Bessie was accepted into the Missionary Baptist Church School on a scholarship. When she turned 18, she took her savings and enrolled in the Oklahoma Colored Agricultural and Normal University in Langston, Oklahoma, which is now known as the Langston University. She finished only one term before her money ran out, and she was forced to return home. When Bessie was 23, she moved to Chicago, Illinois. I didn't say Illinois this time. Where her brother
lived. I was
very
proud of you, by the way. I did notice that.
I know. Well, I had to sneak it in there, you know? She got a job. You can't make everybody happy all the time.
This is very true. You got to pick who you want. You got to take your pick each time.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as I'm making somebody mad about a pronunciation of something, maybe the people who get mad about more serious things like won't see me, I guess. Because pronunciation is
top tier. One way to go about it.
Or maybe everybody will just be mad at me. I don't know. Don't email me. No, do email me. Just not mean things. She got a job as a manicurist at the White Sox Barber Shop. And this is where she began hearing stories of flying during wartime. And she heard these stories from pilots who were returning from World War I. The stories, they inspired her so much that she took a second job as a restaurant manager of a chili parlor in order to save money in hopes of becoming a pilot herself. And so I was like, okay.
Now I feel like I know why I've heard this name.
Probably. So I know like all of that is inspirational and stuff like that, but I was like, what is a chili parlor?
And there it is. Okay.
You know, I'm a nerd. And when I come across like weird shit, I'm going to look it up. So I did look it up. And in short, it's a stew known as chili con carne that originated in northern Mexico. And it's literally just chili. Like what we, like the soup, chili stew or whatever. Which, like, I didn't know that that was the origin for chili. And I'm pretty bummed that, like, this podcast isn't going to be just talking about chili parlors. But,
well, we already talked about hot dogs enough in the last episode, and Kelsey had to take it out. So I think we shouldn't move to chili now. But yeah, all of our outtakes, bloopers, or extra episodes are going to be about food that we just talked about for 15 or 30 minutes.
Truly. Well, I'm like super nerdy about food and like where it comes from and things like that. But it's really interesting. I read through all of it. I'm not going to include all that information in here because, again, we're not a chili parlor podcast. But the link is in the show notes if you want to check it out. And I say definitely do it because like you wouldn't think there'd be a lot on chili in like its origin. But there were women at the time of chili being made that were called chili queens. Like, It's such a cool.
That's pretty nice. Also, is this going to solve the lifelong debate that I hear all the time of whether chili has beans in it or not, a real chili?
The original chili did have beans in it.
There you go. Case closed. Mm-hmm. Mic drop.
Yeah. As we know, some people say that like chili goes all the way back to like Aztec times, but we don't have like an official recipe for it. But yeah, as
we got a calendar that tells us when the end of the world's going to be. I feel like they had their priorities mixed up.
Well, I'm telling you, somebody needs to do their thesis on chili. That's all I'm saying.
Noted. If I ever go back to school. Actually, Megan should definitely get on that.
Oh my God, yes.
Anyway, so we took a detour.
We did. We talk about Megan on this podcast sometimes. I don't even think she listens to it, but we talk about her so often. But I do have to sneak this in. Megan, one time, she was in an interview, and they asked her, you know, like when you're in an interview and they ask you, like, what do you like to do? What are your interests? And Megan just said soup. That was it, because she loves soup. It was so hilarious. She's like, didn't get like, that I job.
Just blanked, and that's just all I could think of.
Poor Megan. Oh, I love her so much. So back to our woman of the hour, Bessie. Having the money for flight school wasn't the only problem Bessie faced in becoming a pilot. American flight schools didn't admit women, and they especially didn't admit Black people at the time. Every school she approached turned her away because of her gender and race. She was also spurred on by her brother, not because he encouraged her to beat the odds, but because, and like literally when I read about this, I was like, this sounds like something Alex would do to Samantha.
I knew that's where this was going to go, but keep going.
He heckled her, saying that French women were superior to African American women because they could fly.
That does sound exactly. And he would just put that on a Facebook post just because.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, like, nothing will get a woman to do something faster than a snotty brother telling her that she can't. Like,
who knows ass. Everything, obviously, especially if they're a younger brother.
I don't know if he was older or younger, but it doesn't matter. Anytime a brother like says anything like that to his sister, they're like, get fucked. I'm going to do it anyway. Like,
actually, you know what's better than you? Literally anything, just because I want to start an argument.
And your face is ugly.
Exactly. And you'd like to think we stopped doing that, but I'm almost 40 and he's younger than me. So no, it doesn't stop. It just keeps going.
Mm-mm. Somehow, and I couldn't figure out how she knew him, but Bessie knew Robert Abbott at the time. He was the owner of the Chicago Defender and one of the first African American millionaires. And he encouraged Bessie to go to France to learn to fly. So before she took the leap to France, she attended the Berlitz School in Chicago, in the Chicago Loop, and learned French there. After that, she withdrew all of her savings and set off for Paris from New York on November 20th, 1920. She also ended up getting like financial assistance from Robert Abbott and another like unnamed African-American entrepreneur. So she wasn't like struggle busing it. While in flight school, Bessie learned to fly in a Newport 564 biplane with a steering system that consisted of a vertical stick, the thickness of a baseball bat in front of the pilot, and a rudder bar under the feet. So it's like, you know, those bumper car systems where they have like the thing in the floor. That's kind of like what that was. Her plane was known to fail frequently, sometimes while in the air.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah.
Prime time. During
her training, she witnessed a fellow student die in a plane crash, which she described as, quote, a terrible shock to her nervous system. Or to her nerves.
You don't say.
That would be like, I'd be like, you know what? Peace out. I'm
good.
I'm out. Okay, bye. She was also the only student of color in her class. However, none of these things deterred her from achieving her goal. And 7 months after she arrived in France in June of 1921, she was awarded an international pilot's license from the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale School.
Wow. Was that fast or was that like normal time frame?
That was normal.
Okay.
It was normal. This was astounding to everyone in America at the time. While there were some female pilots at that time, they were few, and they were every single one of them that were female were rich and white. Bessie was the first female non-white pilot ever. And I say non-white because some people dispute if she was a Black and Native American. So in like several places I found where it says supposed Native American, and then they questioned, like, it was, for instance, I found it was stated, like, in Wikipedia that she was the first Black and self-identified Native American to achieve this goal, which, like, it's hard enough to be a Black woman in America. I don't think she was going to make up an ancestry that was going to oppress her more. Like, what do I know?
No, I think that's one reason why I appreciate it, why a lot of people prefer the term a person of color, just because it's kind of overarching in general, because it doesn't matter whether you're mixed or you have a specific ancestry that you can identify, it kind of covers it all, and you're not isolating anybody either.
Yeah, well, I've heard both sides of the argument, like, I know that a lot of like Black women that I follow on like TikTok, they prefer not to be called a person of color simply because identifying like the severe oppression and discrimination that Black women suffer at is going to be vastly different than, you know, other people of color.
I think ultimately it depends on the person. How you
want
to
identify. Yeah, it definitely depends on the person and what they prefer. But I just... I find that language is it's very important, especially when we talk about things like this. And I get really pissed off when I'm researching something and I come across something like this. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but it is. The language you use that is going to teach others will directly affect the way they process and store that information. So,
well, to say something like self-proclaimed, it hints that you don't feel like she was telling the truth. Whether you do or not, doesn't matter. But in saying that in and of itself, it's like you're saying, we don't really think that that's what it was, but she said it was. So there's a bit of an attitude there that's not necessary at all.
For sure. For sure. After she got her pilot's license, she didn't return to the U.S. right away. Bessie was determined to hone her skills, and she spent the next 2 months taking lessons from a French ace pilot near Paris. In September of 1921, Bessie returned to the U.S. and was greeted to scores of reporters. The Air Service News noted that Bessie had become a full-fledged aviatrix, the first of her race. She was invited as a guest of honor to attend the all-Black musical Shuffle Along. The entire audience, including several hundred whites in the orchestra seats, rose to give the first African-American female pilot a standing ovation. That gave me chills. Like, that's so cool.
I mean, I'm sure it was very overwhelming for her as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well, I don't know. I don't think she probably, you know, thought about it, but like, she's such a determined person, I don't think it would have even like bothered her or anything like that. I don't know.
I have a hard time believing she didn't understand the impact that she was making.
Oh, she understood that impact for
sure. It would have to be overwhelming in general. I mean, even if you were like, well, I'm just doing my thing and this is what I want to do, I think she would still, it would have to be kind of a powerful statement in general.
Oh, for sure.
But again, we were talking about imposter syndrome right before we got on here.
True.
So there definitely could have been that on the sidelines of, I'm just a pilot. I don't understand why this is such a big deal. Who knows?
100%. I will tell you, if I became a pilot, that is how I would feel. Because I probably shouldn't be a pilot. Let's be clear.
Yeah, you'd be in the airplane like, should I should I hit this lever now? Montana, you have flown 500 flights. What? Why are you asking me every single time? I just want to make sure.
I don't know. I'm just so scared. What if I crash us all into a hill?
Please don't.
Oh, man. Bessie would not stay in the U.S. long. She was determined to make a living as a pilot. And at the time, the best way for her to do that was to become a barnstorming stunt flyer. And I was like, okay, well, what is a barnstorming stunt flyer?
Because I was about to ask.
So I looked that up. Barnstorming was a form of entertainment in which stunt pilots performed tricks individually or in groups that were called flying circuses, devised to impress people with the skill of pilots and the sturdiness of planes. It became popular in the United States during the Roaring Twenties. So if you see any of those like old-timey pictures where you've got like those planes flying out and the pilot is like walking out on the wing while it's in the air, that's stunt pilot. That's stunt. That's barnstorming. That's what they did. It's incredible.
So kind of like the jet flyers that, what is it? The Blue Angels. That's kind of like the modern day version.
Yeah. The planes are, but these are like those planes, those
obviously,
wow.
That's why I said modern day version, a little different. Yeah.
But yeah, it was basically a sky circus is what a lot of people kind of like referred to it as. It's insane.
Hopefully she got a better plane and not one that was going to crash in the midair while she was doing tricks.
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay.
Bessie needed more advanced lessons to achieve this goal. Even though she was a media sensation on her arrival back into the U.S., she still couldn't find anyone willing to teach her there. So, in February of 1922, she packed up her shit and sailed back to Europe. Bessie spent the next 2 months in France completing an advanced course in aviation. Then she traveled to the Netherlands to meet with Anthony Fokker, one of the world's most distinguished aircraft designers. After that, she headed to Germany, where she visited the Fokker Corporation and received additional training from one of the company's chief pilots. So she's fucking doing the thing. With all of this training under her belt, Bessie returned to the U.S. to start her career in exhibition flying. She was known as Queen Bess. It comes full circle.
I had full faith that it would.
Ah.
Eventually. See, you did miss out on an opportunity, though.
I did.
You could have used aviation gin.
I know, but I don't have aviation gin. I don't know if we have it around here. I should probably go get that. We do enough, like, plane shit, or I do,
apparently,
to really excuse that. Well, anyways, she was a super popular draw in these shows. Like, people would line up to go and see her. It was insane. She was invited to important events and was often interviewed by newspapers. She was admired by both black and white people, and for these shows, she didn't have her own plane. She was provided a plane for the shows.
Yeah, but I have to think, I mean, I guess back then maybe not, but were there not different types? Like, she could just fly just about anything? Like,
there were different types, but a lot of them were the same. Like, they called them, like, Jennies. They were kind of, like, along the same line. Because, I mean, they're all built by the same companies and crap like that, but they were typically pretty much the same. So the plane she eventually ends up buying is very similar to the plane she learned on. Bada bing, bada boom. But yeah, she primarily flew Curtiss JN4 Jenny biplanes and other aircraft that had been army surplus and aircraft left over from the war. So again, she was like provided these things. And a lot of the places where they did these shows were like, you know, military honors and like veterans, you know, celebration, all of that stuff. She made her first appearance in an American air show on September 3rd, 1922, at an event honoring veterans of the All Black 369th Infantry Regiment of World War I. Held at Curtiss Field on Long Island near New York City and sponsored by her friend, Robert Abbott, and the Chicago Defender newspaper. The show billed Coleman as, quote, the world's greatest woman flyer, unquote, and featured aerial displays by 8 other American ace pilots and a jump by black parachutist Hubert Julian. 6 weeks later, Coleman returned to Chicago, performing in an air show, this time to honor World War I's 370th Infantry Regiment. She delivered a stunning demonstration of daredevil maneuvers, including figure eights, loops, and near ground dips to a large and enthusiastic crowd at the Checkerboard Aerodrome. The thrill of the stunt flying and the admiration of cheering crowds were only part of Bessie's dream. Bessie never lost sight of her childhood vow to one day, quote, amount to something, unquote. As a professional aviator, Bessie often...
Hang on. To one day be something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, the imposter syndrome thing? Like, yeah. We still... I'm the first of all, but it's not good enough. I need to do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've really been resting on my laurels. I got to figure this out. I got to step it up.
Truly. Truly. Oh, my God. As a professional aviator, Bessie often would be criticized by the press for her opportunistic nature and the flamboyant style she brought to her exhibition flying. She also quickly gained a reputation as a skilled and daring pilot who would stop at nothing to complete a difficult stunt. Which, like, I feel like that is, like, women get criticized so often. Like, no matter what we do, there's always going to be somebody, typically a man, who is going to criticize what we do. It could be the best thing ever. We could solve world hunger. But men would say, well, they should have done it this way. And it's doubly worse for a woman, a black woman. So, like, to be in that situation where you're such, like, a skilled person in this field and, like, people are admiring you and all of this other stuff, but then to have people come out and be like, well, she's too risky. It makes me so mad. It makes me so mad.
But it also shows how much things have not changed.
Yeah.
From even back then and in that situation, you're still like, it's not social media. It's just given people a little bit more free rein to do it. I think that probably wouldn't have done it before, but still, like,
yeah.
Siri, okay, sure, whatever. Those that can't do complain and criticize. Yes.
It's typically, and it's like, it's probably like a man behind a keyboard or behind a newspaper or whatever. Like, she doesn't know any, and he's never even seen a plane in his life. Like, he's talking about something he doesn't know anything about. God.
Or the guy when you go to, go to breweries and for football games, and everybody's commenting on how the coach is doing such a terrible job because they don't know how to do stuff. And I'm like, dude, did you even play football in high school? Like, you don't look like it. So my wild guess would be no.
Yeah, truly. Oh, man. In Los Angeles, she actually ended up breaking a leg and 3 ribs when her plane stalled and crashed on February 22nd, 1923. So she was risking it for the biscuit. This stuff is not easy. Obviously.
Do we know? I'm assuming this isn't her first crash, but I mean, even just to land in a way that you didn't die. Those seem minor injuries comparatively.
Yeah, for sure. They are kind of minor injuries for a crash. I think this was her first crash. I think it didn't say that she had ever, like, crashed before. You know, when a plane stalls out in the air, sometimes you can get it on ground safely without crashing. So
I'm sure it's not easy. I would have to guess.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, it's super easy. Like, I could do it in my sleep, Samantha. What are you talking about?
But you're not a doctor.
But I'm not a doctor. We've cleared that up. Bessie not only wanted to promote aviation, she also wanted to There it is. One, yeah.
You made it 36 minutes.
I did. Thank you. Bessie not only wanted to promote aviation, she also wanted to combat racism. She spoke to audiences across the country about the pursuit of aviation and goals for African Americans. She refused to participate in any aviation events that would not allow African Americans to attend. which of that time was pretty common.
Putting her money where her mouth is, basically.
Mm-hmm. And she had the leverage to do that. Like, that's huge. In the 1920s, she met the Reverend Hezekiah Hill and his wife, Viola, on a speaking tour in Orlando, Florida. The community activists invited her to stay with them at the Personage of Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church on Washington Street in the neighborhood of Paramore. A local street was renamed after Bessie, so they changed the name in that area to Bessie Coleman Street in her honor in 2013. The couple who treated her as a daughter persuaded her to stay, and Coleman opened a beauty shop in Orlando to earn extra money to buy her own plane. Through her media contacts, she was offered a role in a feature-length film titled Shadow and Sunshine to be financed by the African-American Seminole Film Producing Company. She did accept, like, happily accept this. She figured, like, the publicity would help advance her career and provide her with some, like, extra money that she needed to establish her own flying school. Because not only does she want to buy her own plane, she also wanted to open a flying school that would accept Black people and women. But when she learned that the first scene in the movie required her to appear in tattered clothes with a walking stick and a pack on her back, she refused to proceed. And when, like, I first read this, I was like, why would she walk off out like that? Did she just, like, not? I knew there was a reason, but I couldn't figure it out like on my own. And don't come at me about that. I haven't lived under the thumb of, like, racial oppression my entire life, so I'm still learning. But a quote from Doris Rich about Bessie walking off set helped me understand why she might have done it. And it's, quote, clearly Bessie's walking off the movie set was a statement of principle. Opportunist though she was about her career, she was never an opportunist about race. She had no intention of perpetuating the derogatory image most whites had of most Blacks, and unquote. Which, yeah, true. Now I get it. Bessie did eventually purchase her own plane, a Curtiss JN4, the Jenny, in Dallas. Her mechanic and publicity agent, 24-year-old William D. Wills, flew the plane from Dallas in preparation for an air show and had to make 3 forced landings along the way because the plane had been so poorly maintained. When Bessie's friends and family heard about how bad of shape this plane was in, they begged her not to fly it, but Bessie wouldn't be dissuaded. On April 30th, 1926, while in Jacksonville, Florida, Bessie would take to the skies for the last time. On takeoff, Wills was flying the plane with Bessie in the other seat. She was planning a parachute jump for the next day, and she was not harnessed in to the seat so she could, like, look over the side of the plane and examine the terrain, just get a feel for what to expect the following day. And about 10 minutes into the flight, the plane unexpectedly went into a nosedive and then a spin at 3,000 feet above the ground. Bessie was thrown from the plane at 2,000 feet and was killed instantly when she hit the ground. Wills was unable to regain control of the plane, and it plummeted to the ground. He died upon impact. The plane exploded, bursting into flames. Although the wreckage of the plane was badly burned, it was later discovered that a wrench used to service the engine had been jammed into the controls. So, like,
it was intentional.
We don't know.
Yeah, the wrench accidentally got jammed in.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been left behind by a mechanic. But, you know, speculate if you want. There were a lot of people who would have wanted her out of the skies at that time. Hell, there's a lot of people nowadays that would want somebody like her out of the skies, which is so fucked. Excuse my language. Fuck. When she died, Bessie was 34 years old. Funeral services were held in Florida before her body was sent back to Chicago. While there was little mention in most media, news of her death was widely carried in the African American press. 10,000 mourners attended her ceremonies in Chicago, which were led by activist Ida B. Wells, which I didn't know she was the one who did it. That's so cool. Sad, but cool. While Bessie did not live long enough to establish a school for young Black aviators, her pioneering achievements served as an inspiration for a generation of African-American men and women. Quote, because of Bessie Coleman, wrote Lieutenant William J. Powell in Black Wings in 1934. Dedicated to Coleman, we have overcome that which was worse than racial barriers. We have overcome the barriers within ourselves and dared to dream. Powell served in a segregated unit during World War I and tirelessly promoted the cause of Black aviation through his book, his journals, and the Bessie Coleman Aero Club, which he founded in 1929. So a school did open because of her. Coleman's example proved an inspiration for a number of pioneers in aeronautics and eventually astronautics, including, that's astronauts, people probably know. Sorry. Including John Robinson, Cornelius Coffey, Willa Brown, Janet Harmon Bragg, Robert H. Lawrence Jr., and Mae Jamison. And that is the life and death of Bessie Coleman and legacy. She's there. I could go through, like, you know, all of the things that were like renamed or made in her name, but that list is fucking long. So go to the Wikipedia page, scroll all the way to the bottom. It's there. That's that on that.
Good job. That was amazing.
Thanks.
I definitely had heard her name before, and I think I've heard an kind of a very brief summary of it, but I've never heard her full story. So that was impressive and amazing and perfect for this month.
I know.
Celebrating her and her achievements. Even Truly. The ones that she didn't, unfortunately, get to see herself.
Yeah, I was really sad about that. But then that quote from Powell, that's so powerful. Like, and makes me almost tear up even thinking about it. Because, like, he's right. When he said, we have overcome that which is worse than racial barriers, we have overcome the barriers within ourselves and dared to dream. I was like, she gave you that. And that's, I mean, like, just her, like, tireless, like, I'm sorry I'm saying like so much, her tireless push towards achieving a dream that seems unachievable at that time. My heart. I love it so much.
Yeah, and she just wouldn't give up. I mean, can't get it done in the U.S.? That's fine. I'll just go to France.
Yeah.
Bye.
I'll learn how to speak French and I'll just go over there and do
I'll do you one better. I won't just get a U.S. flight license. I'll get an international. How about that?
Yeah. Holy shit. So, to Bessie Coleman.
And I would cheers. I can't cheer. But
yeah. Yes, and all the adventurous, wonderful, determined women out there. Happy Women's History Month. Okay, bye. We love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come.